I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, as we conclude a week of reflection on last week's tragedy at Fort Hood, we have a conversation with a leading thinker on the interaction between Islam and the West. That's our weekly Faith Matters conversation, and it's coming up in just a few minutes. But first, the ongoing battle over the health care overhaul, a bill to revise the way insurance companies do business and offer options to people who don't have access to health coverage otherwise, was narrowly approved this past Saturday in the House of Representatives. The House leadership, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, secured the final votes by agreeing to an amendment sponsored by Democratic Representative Bart Stupak to ban coverage of abortion in any government-funded or government-subsidized insurance plan. That includes abortion coverage. Now, however, abortion rights supporters are outraged, saying they will not agree to adopt any final bill that includes that language. But abortion rights opponents say they won't support a bill without it. We'll hear more about the politics of the fight in a few minutes, but first we've enlisted Julie Appleby of Kaiser Health News to explain exactly what the abortion language says and what it would do, because she's been covering this issue extensively. She joins us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Julie, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What exactly does the Stupak Amendment say?
The Stupak Amendment says that you cannot use any federal money in the exchange to cover policies that cover abortion. So basically that means the public option is not going to cover abortion except in the case to save the life of the mother or in the cases of rape or incest. And for the private plans that are sold there, they cannot sell a policy to somebody who gets a subsidy that covers abortion. However, it does allow insurers to create totally separate policies that would cover abortion that could be sold to people who buy it with their own money, who don't use any of the subsidy money from the federal government, and or to create so-called abortion riders that people could buy. Even if you get a subsidy, you'd use your own money, buy this subsidy rider that would cover abortion.
In current health care plans, how is abortion coverage handled?
Well, most people have their coverage through their jobs, and most insurers, about 87% of insurers, according to the Guttmacher Institute, do cover abortion. And the Kaiser Family Foundation did a survey of employers back in 2003 and found that about 46% of workers have abortion coverage. So for most people who have job-based coverage, they probably cover abortion.
Do we have any sense of how many people this would affect? How many women would likely be covered by either the public option plan or would be using a government subsidy to purchase coverage and so therefore would be affected by this restriction if it goes into effect?
It could be quite a few because the exchanges are going to be open to the uninsured, and there's 46, 47 million folks who are uninsured. It'll be open to people who buy their own insurance right now, and there's about 18 million of those. And it would be open to certain small businesses initially. And over time, they're talking about expanding it to larger businesses. So we're talking about a lot of folks would be in these exchanges.
Can you, and I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this, but I'll ask this in case. Those who support this amendment say this is merely a logical extension of existing federal policy, which bans the use of federal funds to pay for abortions. And they say all this does is extend this language, this existing policy to a new context. And, of course, the opponents of this measure say that this is not true, that this extends this ban to a whole other range of circumstances. Can you weigh in on that?
There is an existing law that's called the Hyde Amendment. It was adopted in 1976, so it's been around for a long time. It bars federal money from being used for abortion. So basically, if you're in the military, if you're a federal employee, if you get your care through the Indian Health Services, or you are on Medicaid, chances are pretty good you are not covered for abortion services. There are 17 states that use their own state money to provide abortion beyond what the Hyde Amendment allows. The Hyde Amendment does allow abortion in the case to save the life of the mother and in cases of rape or incest. So that is correct. But what folks are worried about is the Hyde Amendment has to be reauthorized every year. This would not. This would go into place. It would be there. And they're worried that there might be some creep. It might become larger and larger over time because if insurers decide not to offer two policies in the plan, one that covers abortion and one that doesn't in the exchange, they're worried that eventually there might not be coverage for folks in the exchange for abortion.
Julie Appleby reports for Kaiser Health News. She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now we go to Congresswoman Diana DeGette. She represents the 1st District of Colorado in the Congress. She is a Democrat. She's co-chair of the Congressional Pro-Choice Caucus. She's authored a letter that has been co-signed by more than 40 of her colleagues saying they will not support a final bill that includes the Stupak Amendment. And she joins us now by phone from her district. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
good to be with you.
Congresswoman, can I just ask you the same question I asked Julie? The supporters of the STUPAC amendment say that this just extends existing federal policy, and you say it goes further than that. Why do you say it goes further than that?
I really have to disagree with Julie in the scope of what this STUPAC amendment is, because I know Congressman STUPAC has been saying all this does is apply the Hyde Amendment, but in fact it goes much, much further. What the Hyde Amendment says is, as you said, no federal funds shall be used to pay for abortions. That has been in the law for many years, and it's well established. The pro-choice caucus doesn't really like it, but we accept it. You know, it's where we're at. And in fact, in my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, we put language into the bill, which was in the bill when it came to the floor, which preserved the Hyde Amendment. What the STUPAC Amendment says is nobody in the exchange or in the public option can purchase an insurance plan that covers a full range of reproductive services, even with their own money. So, for example, the public option, now it's set up by the government, but it's not paid for by government funds. A middle-class businesswoman from Denver, for example, who's having trouble getting insurance now because she's a small business, might want to buy a plan with her own money, 100% her own money, in this public option. She would not be able to get a full range of reproductive care.
Well, there are those who say that these companies could offer a separate rider.
Well, I think the idea...
In the same way, for example, and not to trivialize the matter at all, but in the same way that in your home insurance, for example, you can buy a separate rider for valuable items like a wedding ring or something of that sort that isn't included in the core plan. They're saying it's the same thing.
That does trivialize it, mm-hmm. because, in fact, it's an unplanned pregnancy or a planned pregnancy that goes terribly wrong is never in anybody's planning. If you have a wedding ring... You know it might get stolen. You put a rider on your homeowner's policy. But, for example...
But why couldn't someone reasonably anticipate people may or may not choose long-term care insurance. They may or may not choose other forms of insurance that are on riders. Are you saying that these companies would not offer these riders, or are you saying that people would not buy them?
I'm saying women would never buy them because they wouldn't think that they would have an unplanned pregnancy. It's just like saying you have to get a rider to buy cancer coverage or something like that. People don't plan on getting that. And we actually think, the pro-choice caucus thinks, that we can have a resolution here. We're trying to be reasonable. What we're saying is we will agree to compromise to have the Hyde Amendment, but don't do an amendment that goes far beyond that and then say that's just the Hyde Amendment. And so we're still talking to people. We're still working with them on language. Something else, people say, well, in the exchange, if people get premium assistance, then they can't buy a plan with abortion coverage. But it's the same thing. Let's say you have $100 a month you're paying for your premium, and $10 is a subsidy, and $90 is your own money. We say you should be able to take your own money and apply that to a full policy. There's nothing in current law that prevents people from, with their own money, buying insurance.
And you're saying this amendment would, in your view, allow people from with their own. And finally, throughout the health care debate, as we have talked with lawmakers across the political spectrum, we have asked them, what is your bottom line? We asked, for example, House Majority Whip James Clyburn this question at the beginning of the week, and he said while he does not like this amendment, that he feels that the overriding goal of extending health care coverage to people who don't presently have it has to be the objective, and he would reluctantly vote for final passage, even if this amendment is included. What about you?
Well, I circulated a letter, and 41 people have signed it, saying this is too high a price to pay. If by some remote possibility the bill came back with this exact language in it, we would say take the bill off the table and go work on it. Now, having said that, I think we can come up with a compromise. In my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, we were able to come up with some compromise language that preserved the separation of federal funds in this legislation. And it's called the CAPS Amendment. And if people think that we can improve on that, if we can make it more clear that we're not going to spend federal money for abortions, we're happy to work with them on that, and we think we can. I've already talked to several senators this week who are working on it. But this particular amendment, it goes way farther than that. And that's what people need to understand. We're not trying to be unreasonable. We've compromised to keep the Hyde Amendment. This Stupak Amendment will prevent millions of women from getting legal medical services. And that's our concern.
Congresswoman, finally, if I could just press you one more time on this whole question of the rider. You're saying that people won't buy these riders if offered. People do buy riders for health care issues all the time. I mean, people now who buy individual policies on the open market can choose or choose not to buy coverage for maternity services, thinking they may or may not get pregnant. So why is this different?
Let me try it again. Mm-hmm. Unlike maternity services where you think, you know, I really might want to get pregnant and have a baby, people don't plan for an unwanted pregnancy. They don't plan to get pregnant when they didn't want to or to have a planned pregnancy that goes terribly wrong. And so they're not going to think, I better pay extra money every month in case this unplanned situation happens. And that's the problem with a rider.
And can I just
also, why should you have to do that with this one? You know, an abortion is a legal medical procedure, just like many other medical procedures. Why should you just single this one procedure out?
Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado, she's co-chair of the Congressional Pro-Choice Caucus. She was kind enough to join us today by phone from her district. Congresswoman, we thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up in the wake of the Fort Hood shooting, we've asked one of the leading thinkers on Islam and the West, what, if anything, does Muslim identity have to do with what happened at Fort Hood? His answer may surprise you. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about health care legislation and abortion. The nation's Catholic bishops have been lobbying intensely to make sure that any kind of health care overhaul includes restrictions on abortions. Joining us now to talk more about this is Michael Sean Winters. He writes a daily political blog for the largest circulation Catholic weekly magazine, America. Michael, welcome to the program. Welcome back, I should say.
Always good to be with you, Michelle.
Michael, many liberals whom we've heard from in recent days have been outraged about the Catholic Church's lobbying intensely on this abortion restriction question. And so can you they say they don't understand why it is that a religious organization is allowed to, if I can use that phrasing, to participate so directly in the legislative process in that way. So can you just talk a little bit more about that?
You know, the bishops speak for the Catholic Church, and there's millions of Catholics in this country. They're not just speaking for themselves, exercising their First Amendment rights, although they have the right to do that, but they're speaking for millions of pro-life Catholics who both want health care reform but are deeply opposed to seeing the Hyde Amendment thrown under the bus and want to see the federal government continue its current policy of not providing federal funds for abortion.
And you heard Congresswoman Diana DeGette argue that the Stupak Amendment, which applies to the health care overhaul legislation, goes beyond the Hyde Amendment. It would restrict women from using even their own money to pay for abortion coverage. What is the bishop's perspective on that? Do they think that that's true?
I think she missed something. You know, the Hyde Amendment and was not designed to save money. The Hyde Amendment and the Stupak Amendment reflect the deep ambivalence of most Americans. And the congresswoman, like a sliver of the electorate, is adamantly pro-choice, and there's a sliver that's adamantly pro-life. But I think the center of the electorate is just deeply ambivalent, and they don't want abortion to be illegal. No one wants to go back to the back alley days. But they also don't want to encourage it through federal subsidies. And when she says, oh, abortion is just like any other medical procedure, that's not true. It is fraught with a moral content that I can't think of any other medical procedure that carries that moral weight.
There are those, though, who would argue that this is a sectarian, this is a religious value, not a civic value that's being imposed on those who do not share those religious values. What would the bishop say about that?
They would point to the Declaration of Independence, which states the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and say, what about life? What's going on there? And they're deeply committed to the defense of life from conception to natural death, and You know, for us, this just is really not a negotiable item. And the Catholic Church has a mission called Project Rachel that works with women who've been traumatized by abortions and have feelings of guilt and all that. I just don't believe that ignoring the moral content of this issue really serves it. And to be still invoking the CAPS Amendment, which was too clever by half. If Michelle, if you and I go off,
you'd have to explain what that is, I'm afraid.
The CAPS
as
Amendment,
briefly as you can. Mm-hmm.
The congressman was saying that actually extended Hyde to the health care, and it didn't. The CAPS Amendment says, well, the public subsidies will be kept separate from the individual's own money to pay for the same plan. But if you and I go out for pizza and I give you $10 and you pay $10 of your own, I'm not buying the cheese or the crust. What the church is saying is an abortion in that analogy would be like an add-on, like a pepperoni, and you've got to pay your own $2 by using these riders, and you are free to do so under the Stupak Amendment.
I'm sorry, Mike, I just have one more point that I have to get to before we let you go, and that is the question we've been asking everybody who we've the lawmakers particularly who are involved in this debate. We're asking, what's your bottom line? And the question for, as you heard Diana DeGette say, that she's not willing to vote for a bill that, in her view, it takes the Hyde Amendment too far. And at the end of the day, health care reform, even if it means some form of subsidy for abortions, would benefit millions of Americans. And the Catholic Church has been deeply concerned about the lack of health coverage for these millions of Americans who don't have it. Are they willing to see the bill die rather than go forward with this language?
I would say this. I think, you know, and certainly President Obama has to know that if all of the Stupak language goes, that he is imperiling all of his outreach to moderate, centrist, pro-life and Catholic voters that he's worked very, very hard on. I think there's one part of Stupak that needs to be clarified, which is this issue of the riders. And I suspect if they were to add additional language that insists one of the plans, not available for public subsidies, but one of the plans in these exchanges must cover abortion or must allow, have a rider so that it is actually available for a woman who is paying with her own money, I think that may be the final compromise. But on the issue of the public option, but also federally subsidized plans, that's a deal breaker.
Michael Sean Winters writes a daily political blog for the largest circulation Catholic weekly magazine, America. He was kind enough to join us from KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Michael Sean, always good to hear from you.
Have a good day, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and Gustavo Arellano, who writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Oh, man. Well, let's jump right in. Lou Dobbs abruptly calls it quits on a CNN broadcast Wednesday. Now, Dobbs, who has been somewhat of a lightning rod for his outspoken views on illegal immigration, he didn't say what his next move would be, but, quote, is considering a number of options and directions, unquote. And I'm sure there are a lot of Latinos that wouldn't mind telling him where to go and how to get there.
I love his language. Did you hear what he said? Somewhat of a lightning rod. What have you, like, since when have we embraced
the
British understatement?
What's
going on here?
Seriously, man.
I cannot. Right. My email was overloaded with people burning up my email about this. But anyway, do you want to hear what he said when he stepped down, for those of you who missed the announcement, which I think was a surprise, I think.
An hour before his live broadcast.
Before his last broadcast. Anyway, if you're interested, I'll just play a short clip of what he had to say about why. Here it is.
Over the past 6 months, it's become increasingly clear that strong winds of change have begun buffeting this country and affecting all of us. And some leaders in media, politics, and business have been urging me to go beyond the role here at CNN and to engage in constructive problem solving, as well as to contribute positively to a better understanding of the great issues of our day, and to continue to do so in the most honest and direct language possible.
I just want to add one thing to that. I asked him, you know, Lou Dobbs was on the program in November of 2007. He was promoting a book, whatever his latest book was at that time. And I specifically asked him, I said, well, if you care this deeply about this stuff, why don't you run yourself? Why don't you get out there?
Uh-oh.
And he said, no.
Thanks
no.
a lot, Michelle.
Well, no, I'm just saying.
Thanks, Michelle.
Okay. All right, Jimmy.
Well, thanks, Michelle. And, you know, not for nothing, this isn't the first time he's resigned from CNN. He's been with the network since they started in 1980. This is his second resignation. He resigned once in 1999, and he came back the next year. So I don't know. Gustavo, my man, do you think we'll see him come back to CNN?
Oh, I don't know about coming back to CNN, but this is not the last we've seen of Dobbs. First and foremost, though, congratulations to those groups who have really been exposing Dobbs for the man that he is, for the disgusting man that he is, BastaDobbs.com specifically, who would make these videos just showing the worst clips of Dobbs. Dobbs saying that Latinos have brought in 3,000 cases of leprosy in the past 3 years, when the Center for Disease Control says,
yikes,
no, it's actually been 3,000 cases overall in the past 30 years. So thank God the man's off, but I think those opponents of Dobbs, they got to be careful as to what his next step is. Is it going to be Fox Business Channel, like some say? Maybe. Will he run for office? Perhaps. I personally think he's probably going to join some think tank like the American Enterprise Institute, one of those conservative think tanks, and really try to affect legislative policy that in some ways is going to make him much more dangerous than him just yapping his mouth on CNN every night.
You know, the Fox Business Channel would be a good fit for him. You know, he can flex that degree he got from Harvard in 67 in economics. Harvard, stand up. Pablo, my
thanks,
man.
Jimmy.
Harvard will, in fact, stand up. Listen, I like to view this, as much as I want to view this as a victory for the marketplace of ideas that we're sort of informally or at least de facto ousting his voice, I think it's as much a victory for the marketplace of business. You know, I think this is a great move for CNN. I think they're not going to be Fox News. They're not going to be MSNBC. I think what they're trying to do is show that they can't be the channel of record with a guy who's talking about leprosy, who's blaming, you know, a third of prison inmates blaming illegal immigration for a third of prison inmates. I think, you know, they want to go something along the lines of the Anderson Cooper route, which John King most certainly is, less ideological, less aggressively moronic, less incendiary.
Let me just
more
clarify for
facts.
Those. Dobbs was replaced by John King, who's CNN's host of the Sunday political show State of the Union. Of course, King has been with CNN for many years, but before that, he was a reporter for the Associated Press and obviously works very, very hard to kind of keep his personal opinions out of the whole thing. For me, the issue with Dobbs was twofold. I mean, his opinions, however noxious to, you know, some, embraced by others, the issue is, are you about the facts or not? I mean, if you're going to be at a cable channel that wants to be the sort of the broadcast outlet of record, you got to be about your facts. And I think that, you know, Pablo pointed out Gustavo, that his acquaintanceship with facts became very, very tenuous over the years. And secondly, the fact that reporters who were trying to be straightforward reporters and just report the facts were constantly put in a position of having to answer to him in the host position, where he would then browbeat them for not taking on his political perspective in their reporting. And to me, that was what was problematic about it. Because there are people like Bill O'Reilly, everybody knows where he's coming from, and you may not like where he's coming from, but it wasn't as problematic an arrangement. It wasn't, you know, you weren't pretending to be one thing while doing another. That was, you know.
I guess for me, I never looked at him as a journalist. I always looked at him as ideologue with the show. You know, who was pushing his worldview through this filter. He's kind of like, Rush Light, you know, in a lot of ways. Just, he takes a piece of the facts and, you know, he takes his filter and he pushes his opinion through.
Yeah, you weren't required to. I mean, if you're, let's say you're a reporter for CNN, you weren't required to appear on Rush Limbaugh's program. If you're a reporter for CBS News, let's say Rush Limbaugh might be carried on the CBS radio network. Okay. CBS reporters wouldn't be required to appear on his program. That's what's problematic about it.
I see. Well, train.
This is Arsalan. You know, for me, I think that he left CNN because he wanted to spend a little bit more time with his racism. He talks about the strong winds of change, and I hope those winds of change, hit him right as he walked out the door, because we're talking about advocacy journalism. You know, that's what we're talking about, where you're not a traditional journalist by the textbook definition. You're an advocacy journalist, and Michelle's absolutely right. I mean, I have friends who are reporters on CNN who, you know, are reporting factual stories as journalists, and then, like Michelle said, you know, had to go on and had to deal with his advocacy journalism. So, you know, I'm playing the world's smallest violin for him right now.
Just to clarify, just to be fair about it, insists that he is not a racist. I mean, in fact, I think he appeared
before.
He has
a Latina wife.
Yes, he does. And I just he feels that he's standing up for people who he's saying what others won't say. But again, I think it's inexcusable to be wrong on something like that leprosy charge or something as explosive as that, and to simply be wrong. It's inexcusable, particularly when you have the resources of a major international news organization to check your facts. But anyway, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop segment, and we're speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Pablo Torre, and Gustavo Arellano. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, former Major League slugger Sammy Sosa in the news after he showed up at the Latin Grammys earlier this month appearing muy blanco. Now, Sosa, now wait a second. Now, Sosa, he says he was using a skin cream that many people believe, he won't confirm or deny, but many people believe is a product called NUR76, NUR76 is a cream used for skin lightening and anti-aging applications. It's widely available in Europe and Asia, and not by accident. It reportedly does $20 million in sales annually. So bust that, you know. But I saw a dude, and dude looked mad scared. He looked like he was going to the audition for a Thriller the Musical. I don't know what's going on in his head. Pablo, help me out.
Yeah, this is, on one level, of course, it's troubling for the same reason that the Michael Jacksoning of Michael Jackson was troubling, that you're sort of, it's seemingly de facto prizing this Western white ideal. You know, he was a dark-skinned guy. He was not proficient in English. It seems to be a sort of transformation of his character, which further sort of makes the saga of Sammy Sosa all the more absurd. I mean, think back to 98, him in his home run chase with Mark McGwire. They were both heroes. We both learned since then they're both vastly different men than we thought they were. You know, they appeared on the cover of SI as Greek Olympians, as Sportsman of the Year. And now beyond, I mean, obviously this is a superficial thing mostly, but beyond that, we of course have the steroid revelation. The New York Times discovered was guilty of that. Right. And McGwire obviously is pretty much dead to rights as far as that goes as well. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to hear this, Michelle. I don't know if you guys want to hear this. There's a Univision's Tony Dandrades asked Sosa earlier this week if he's proud of being black. I can play it for you. It's in Spanish. I'll translate if you want.
Sure, here, okay, here yeah, absolutely. Okay. Why not? Mm-hmm.
Here it is. Estoy orgulloso, Sammy Sosa, de ser negro.
Todo el tiempo. Así fue que yo nací, Tony. Ahora bien, que quiero lucir mejor, mi vida entera siempre lo ha hecho. Yo no veo ningún tipo de problema con eso, pero no me olvido de dónde vengo.
So he was asked if he's proud to be black, and he says, all the time, that's the way I was born. Now I want to look better. My whole life I have wanted to look better. I don't see any problem with that, but I don't forget where I came from. So, I mean, well,
that's okay.
I got, look.
Thanks for that, Michelle. You know, and for all the sisters that are out there that said, there goes another good black man, just so you know, It won't stick. You know, the product just limits your melanin for a limited period of time, and it is reversible. So,
but is that dangerous? Can I ask Pablo? Isn't that dangerous to be using a product like that if you're going to be out in the sun?
I can't imagine it's a good idea on a variety of levels. I think medically, I think the fact that it's legal in Europe and Asia does not necessarily provide a stamp of approval as far as health reasons goes.
Right.
Did he not think anyone would notice?
Yeah, that's a troubling part. He's on the red carpet at the, with the Latin Grammys or whatever it was. And that's, in this day and age, I don't think you can hide anywhere, specifically not in an awards ceremony in which you are this guy who's been reviled and alternately praised throughout the past decade for a variety of baseball feats. You know, drawing your attention to yourself in this way is not the way to go, I think.
But wait a minute.
Can I ask Gustavo, though, is this whole skin lightening product thing big in Latin America?
It's the first time I've ever heard of it. Although I have to say, being from Mexico, we do have a very tiny Afro-Mexican community, and that, of course, that would ostensibly be the population that would want to lighten their skin. Years ago, in the 50s, there was a famous Mexican film about that where you had an Afro-Mexican trying to lighten her skin to try to pass in Mexican society. And if Sammy Sosa is indeed trying to lighten his skin because he has some issue with the color of his skin, I find it really sad, especially in the Dominican Republic, which has such a large Afro-Dominican community, yet historically the people who have been in power have been lighter-skinned Dominicans. And And always, though, even the Afro legacy has been diminished. I think who's a famous dictator from the Trujillo, I believe his last name is, or whatever. But he was of African blood, yet he always tried to pass himself off more as European. So Sosa just seems to be going down that sad trajectory, which is sad, because if you think of the great Latino ball players, especially from the Caribbean, like Roberto Clemente, Juan Marichal, or Orlando Cepeda, they never made any qualms about the color of their skin. In fact, they were proud of who they were and where they came from, and they didn't mind going out there in the public and showing the people what is the true worth of Dominican and Puerto Rico.
Well, you know, for me, this is Arsalan, I think that, you know, we're living in such dire economic times where all of our paychecks are getting lighter than Sammy Sosa, and so now Sammy Sosa is getting lighter than Sammy Sosa. You know, being from Chicago, you know, seeing his, I mean, you know, we've seen his career, from, you know, from the Chicago Cubs to today, and, you know, we remember his early days, you know, his soul glow Jerry Curl days, and now he looks like some sort of broke sexual white chocolate. So, you know, it's Sammy's really just turned into a circus.
You know what? I say in the age where, you know, you can all this plastic surgery and all this kind of stuff, I say it's his face, it's his skin, it's his body. Sure. Don't judge him. Mm-hmm. Don't judge him.
No, that the first part, yes. Second part, no. What's the point of being a public figure if we can't judge you from afar? Excuse me.
Well,
what would we talk about anyway? Anyway, go ahead, Jimmy.
All right. Well, you know what? With that on the deck, let's get ready to rumble. You know what? The best pound for pound fighter, Manny Pacquiao, a.k.a. the Pac-Man, steps back into the ring against Miguel Cotto. Does anybody think Cotto can get it? Do you think he stands a chance, Pablo?
No. And I've reported on Pacquiao extensively and his trainer, Freddie Roach. And, you know, run, don't walk to your television screen in order this Saturday. Don't mean to put on my Don King hat here, but if you can have the stomach for fights, stomach for boxing, go watch this fight. Pacquiao is going to destroy him, but it'll be really, really entertaining.
How come?
Well, because they're two great storylines. You know, Floyd Mayweather, for example, who's the premier American fighter, you know, he gets the attention for being an American, for being boisterous. These two guys are actually fairly civil. But Pacquiao and Cotto both are A sluggers. They both fight, and they'll take it to them. They'll both undoubtedly have health problems down the road because of it. But also, there's this great storyline. I mean, Manny Pacquiao could be the president of the Philippines in 5 years, and I mean that as no exaggeration.
Right.
He's the most popular man there, and it's terrifying for Filipinos, trust me. Cotto himself is a soft-spoken guy, but, you know, has this history of being an excellent fighter and has a great chin, so it's going to be a good matchup. And there's a bunch of back storylines. Freddie Roach, who I wrote about this week in SI, has Parkinson's disease and speaks to the brain damage risk in boxing, so there's a bunch of stuff that sports writers like me at least love as far as human drama goes.
Anybody else watching it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, Manny Pacquiao is gangster. Like, he is the Michael Jordan of boxing. I think, you know, in terms of, like, analyzing the fight, I do agree Pacquiao is going to win. You know, Cotto tends to cut real easy and give up in the later rounds. And Pacquiao is more of a marathon man who you know, will sort of start in round eight. He'll take the rope-a-dope body punches, you know, for the first. I don't think it's going to be a De La Hoya fight where you're going to see a quick KO. I think it's going to go the distance, and Pacquiao will win probably on points in a split decision.
Jimmy, are you going to watch it?
Absolutely. Knock it out, Michelle.
Jay-Z has already name-checked Manny Pacquiao in his song. I think that means he's a rock in America.
That's gangster.
Wow. Can I just be the girl about this and say, I have no desire to watch grown men beat each other up for money?
Yeah.
None. Zero. Zippo.
You shouldn't watch football then either.
Oh, well.
Yeah, Michelle, you should read On Boxing by Joyce Carol Oates, which is about a short little 50-page book where she talks about, just in her own lyrical fashion, the beauty of boxing. Boxing, really, I love it. It's an amazing sport. Manny Pacquiao, he's the Pac-Man. He's also the Mexicutioner. He destroyed
One of my best friends is a boxing writer, and she's a woman, but I still ain't doing it. Sorry, I love y'all.
He's destroyed every great Mexican boxing champion of this past generation.
All right, we got to leave it there,
he's
Pablo.
Just a great guy.
Love
great
you.
Guy.
Pablo Torres, reporter, as you can tell, for Sports Illustrated. Yes. He likes boxing. He joined us from our New York studios. Gustavo Arellano is a syndicated columnist who writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He was kind enough to join us from member station KUCI in Irvine, California. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. He joined us from member station WCPN. And Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney and the author of a forthcoming book. He joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gentlemen, thank you.
Peace.
Gracias. Yeah.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More's technical director is Neil Tewalt, with assistance from Greg Gavin. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.